world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world views and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. What do we really want out of South Africa? Do we want to get it to the place that we are in the United States, where we have, as we assume, complete democracy, where we have majority rule, where we have no minority problems, no racism, no strife, no hatred, but instead we have blacks and whites living completely in harmony and peacefully together? You look around, you wonder, what in the world are people expecting to occur in the two of those so very few democratic nations on the southern tip of Africa? You begin to wonder whether or not they honestly feel that we in the United States represent the ideal status in our interracial relationships. Whether or not, in fact, the average American black feels that what we have in the United States is exactly what all the countries ought to have. But I guarantee you, what the average American citizen does not know about Africa is so enormous it would fill probably the entire volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the Americana, and a lot of others put together, perhaps the Jewish and Catholic encyclopedias, and you wouldn't have even begun to scratch the surface of what millions upon millions of Americans do not know about what's happening in Africa. I could scarcely believe what had happened in the wake of the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy, as it's been called, in Rhodesia and South Africa. And as I see what is very likely going to happen in the next couple of years, then I think you will find that what we eventually will be reading in our newspapers will be something very, very tragic indeed. In some of the wealthiest nations, in all of that part of the world, of a very poverty-stricken part of the world, those two very much developed countries, rich in minerals, raw materials, resources, South Africa having the capability to manufacture the atomic bomb if she so chooses, with German technology, building nuclear reactors, with South Africa one of the wealthiest, potentially at least, in minerals such as gold and diamonds of all nations on the face of the entirety of the earth. And yet, what you may see in the next years ahead of us will be those jewels on the African continent gradually disintegrating into the same kind of unbelievable discrimination. Discrimination against foreigners, black markets in sweat labor, naked exploitation of one tribe against another tribe, where African against African will begin to persecute as never before. You know, in Africa, in most places, it's dangerous when revolution time comes along to belong to the wrong race. It's very dangerous. It can cost your property, your home, your life, your family. You can lose everything, include being murdered, if you belong to the wrong race, the wrong political party, or the wrong religion in a time of crisis. Americans are prone to oversimplify the situation in southern Africa by first assuming that the governments of Rhodesia and South Africa have done absolutely nothing for the blacks. And this is a myth. The facts are that those blacks in those two nations have never had it so good, that in spite of what you hear about riots in Soweto, and we've had riots in Los Angeles, no one in Africa could gainsay the fact that the average black in the United States is tremendously wealthy by comparison with the average black in, say, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, Gabon, Congo, Zaire, Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, Sudan, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Niger, and Mali, as well as Algeria, Mauritania, Guinea-Bissau, and Ghana, and throw in a few more if you would like. Any more, then you would be able to argue that all of those black people in those many other African nations have not got even a percentage of the annual income of the average one in southern Africa. The blacks of southern Africa are better off than the blacks in practically any other nation in the entirety of that continent. Now, what we may eventually see in those two nations will be, perhaps at the very best, a gradual transition into black majority rule, which will eventually result in some of the same type decisions which have been taken by other administrations of black majority rule, such as Tanzania and Kenya, which will result in a white flight, a brain drain, which will result then in some of the large plantations, agriculture, industry, business, gradually disintegrating to the point that the economic base of the country will suffer rather enormously. At worst, what you might see is a racial bloodbath, eventually, with uprooted minorities, the victims of war, revolution, and political oppression, actually fleeing back to the veldt and to the jungles to live as they have for the generations before the white man came to South Africa. You know, you can rather harshly criticize a country where you believe apartheid, and a lot of people think that Rhodesia is guilty of apartheid, but they've never been there. They've never seen the fact that there is such a thing as the potential for a black to become a millionaire in the city of Salisbury, which, as a matter of fact, the major bus line down there is owned by a black. They didn't realize you can go freely into the cities of Rhodesia and see black and white mingling in the same stores, restaurants, cafes, department stores, what have you, the same bus lines, that you will see far more blacks on the streets than whites. They don't seem to realize that they have been able to hold not only governmental posts, but rise in business, of course, depending entirely upon merit, depending entirely upon education. And education is not only not denied the blacks of those two countries, but is governmentally to some degree enforced. The government has had a terrible problem in many cases trying to offer not only the kind of housing but the kind of education. Now someone's going to say, well, you're claiming it's an absolute utopia for blacks down there. By no means. There is exploitation. There is such a thing as very poor working conditions and low wages and all the problems of exploitation that you will find in many another nation where it is black over black. There is discrimination. There are black sweat labor markets. This is true. And so there are in countries all over Africa. And my point is, I guess, why is not the American government as interested in calling for justice, in calling for equity, in calling for an end to naked exploitation of low working classes, in calling for an end to black sweat labor markets, discrimination against foreigners, and discrimination against race, tribe, political party, and religion, in nation after nation across Africa, where that is the daily way of life, where millions live in terror. There's an untold story about the continent of Africa, and that is that perhaps the biggest political, social, racial, and religious refugee problem on the face of the earth exists in the so-called black continent. Millions upon millions of people, both blacks and whites, have been dislocated, uprooted, and forced to leave or to flee because of toppling governments, because of rising despotism, because of revolution, and Africa in the grips and the throes of dramatic change. Millions of people, not 10,000, 20,000, or hundreds of thousands, millions. Now, many of them, if you look at a nation such as Uganda, where Dada Idi Amin virtually wiped out a university because of the myth by one of his many children, who was semi-illiterate, who came to him because the students had rebuffed his advances, and you will find that the rule of the boot and the gun is extant. And the despotism, totalitarianism, absolute dictatorships are the way of things in many a nation in Africa. In those nations, the Prime Minister of the United States, the pressure or the threat of sanctions from Britain, from the Western nations, are absent. There is no threat of sanction, of cutting off of diplomatic relations, of denial of the flow of raw materials to many an African nation where the wrong tribe, the wrong race, the wrong political party, or the wrong religion is absolutely exploited, discriminated against, brutalized, and in many cases murdered. And so somehow it doesn't seem to me that we are using the exact same criterion for each individual nation. And that seems to be just a little bit hypocritical. It seems to be a little bit smacking of the double standard. According to the Secretary General of the All-African Council of Churches, and quite an outspoken critic of social injustice, he says Africans have not found a way to change governments except through a coup d'etat. It's unique, he said, that in 20 years you can't point to a single leader in an African nation who has been replaced as head of government by the electoral process, even though that might have been available to them. And the point is, you just don't have democracy in country after country where you do have support from the United States, from Western Europe, Japan, and Asia, and other countries. You got the free exchange of raw materials, the flow of manufactured commodities. You have experts from Western countries as well as Eastern in there working away. And at the same time, you got totalitarianism, blatant racial discrimination of one tribe against another tribe, one religion against another religion. But there is no statement wherever in the press in the West, and there is no move in any parliament or Congress to try to cut off key supplies to these nations where such racism exists. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, by the way, reported back in August of 76 that more than 1 million Africans, that's one family in every 400, are living in exile in 19 nations which have given them refuge and shelter from the many nations where they have had to flee. You know, it's interesting that in the little nation of Mozambique, a former Portuguese colony, after they finally gained their independence here within the last very few years, that almost immediately private properties were confiscated, businesses and industries were taken over by the government, people lost all their civil rights, people suspected the various religious or political differences with the government that had now taken charge with the heel and the gun were summarily sent off to concentration camps. And all the while, the ultra-righteous black leader of that new nation was able to spout his endless spewing forth of invective and venom toward the Prime Minister of Rhodesia across the border, Ian Smith, because of his white regime. But there was no confiscation of property in Rhodesia. There was no dislocating of native populaces in Rhodesia. There was no denial of civil rights. Blacks had freedom and access to universities, to social centers, restaurants, hotels, to buses. It's a rather strange day in which we live, where this pharisaical type of self-righteousness, which on the one hand pretends to be so righteous on the exterior, but which inwardly is full of dead men's bones, people who like to point the finger of guilt toward those who are suspect of guilt, while they themselves who point the finger are guilty of the very thing of which they accuse. It's unbelievable. But in 20 years, you can't point to a single overthrow of government by a democratic process in the continent of Africa. Every one of them has been by dramatic and usually violent change. And as a result, there are millions of uprooted minorities that are on the run. These are the victims of harsh criticism, of absolute discrimination, naked racism and exploitation. They're the victims of war, of revolution, of political and religious oppression. And so the continent of Africa has one of the worst and yet one of the least publicized refugee problems in the entirety of the world. Over 1 million of them. They've had to flee from nations such as Zaire, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Angola, Namibia, Malawi, Nigeria. What about all the problems up between Morocco and the Spanish Sahara? The big march and the confrontation and the bloodshed up there. Ethiopia, a violent revolution. And so, by the millions, people have had to flee from these nations to neighboring nations, such as Zambia, Kenya, Somalia, Libya, Central African Republic, and into South Africa, Botswana, former Bechuanaland. Some of the exiles date back to the civil wars that have faded into people's memory now that were so much a part of our news clear back in the days of the Congo, which is now called Zaire, where, who knows, perhaps millions died. There was never any official tally of the people who lost their lives in a struggle between some of these people, such as the Igbos and the Hausas, where it basically was black against black, tribe against tribe, religion against religion. We don't feel quite so self-righteous when it is a black minority persecuting a black majority. But that happens in country after country in Africa today, where the black intelligentsia, largely educated in British, European, and American universities, who will go to get a doctorate in law, political science, like as not, perhaps go to the London University, or come over to the United States or other countries, go back with a degree, and immediately, instead of getting into the problems and assisting all those not quite so blessed and fortunate to go abroad to study,
to lift them out of the very low level of poverty-ridden life that they daily experience, these individuals begin to exploit. And then they, in turn, resort to all forms of discriminatory racism as they suppress and hold down the largely illiterate black majority of the country to which they return. It's an old, old story. It's been going on for several decades now in Africa, and it's continually going on, and you're going to see, if something doesn't stop it, that eventually even those glittering jewels of all the African continent, those most industrialized, most developed, where there is more in the way of actual, well, you can call it urban development, you can call it civilization, if that's a term you choose, you can call it whatever, development, I guess, is a term which says it all, of South Africa and Rhodesia. And those apparently are going to go the way of Sudan, Nigeria, Zaire, and Uganda, eventually, if something doesn't stop it. A lot of people have forgotten all about Morocco and Mauritania dividing up what had been the Spanish Sahara in early 1976. Now some 40,000 nomadic inhabitants of that very rich territory in phosphates, fertilizers and the like, had to go seek refuge in a neighboring nation, in this case Algeria. There was a civil war that went on for over 15 years in the southern Sudan, where a 500,000 people finally scattered into the bushlands to avoid the bitter fighting between blacks and Arabs. And that basically was animism and tribalism against Muslim religion, as well as racial overtones. You can't really see in just cold statistics of 1,000,000 people on the run the unbelievable suffering that has been worked upon those countless hundreds of thousands of families where new rulers grab power and immediately, because of their race, because of their religion, they're persona non grata and got to flee the border and leave everything they've ever known. For example, 600,000 Portuguese had to evacuate Mozambique and Angola, the two nations at either end of the southern African continent there, when the two Portuguese colonies were given independence, one as a result of a bloody war in Angola. But there were 600,000 of them when Portugal liquidated the last of its African empire. And they had to flee. And those people were largely technicians, trained and educated personnel, businessmen. They were the people who really made the wheels go around in the country. And they fled for fear of their lives. Same story that happened so many years before in what had been called the Belgian Congo, when the city of Leopoldville reported that large estates and office buildings were being looted and burnt, that the people were freely moving in and out of it and just tearing things down, taking things apart. The place was just an absolute shambles in only a matter of weeks, it seemed. You know, Uganda at one time harbored 165,000 refugees from other African countries, but the president, and he calls himself Herr Doctor and I guess the great luminous mucky-muck field marshal and a few dozen other titles, I guess he cut up a few drapes and bedspreads to get some colored cloth and put it on his big ample chest and calls himself a hero, probably for the War of the Okabongu Swamp or something or other, when he went out to attack a wounded elephant that somebody else had already half put out of his misery. I don't know what wars he was in, but anyway, this guy with his chest full of medals, who was very embarrassed when the Israelis got all those refugees back. But it's an unbelievable state that he has created there. He's backed by the comparatively small Kakwa tribe, but he's not only created impossible, intolerable conditions for his own people, but he has little, if any, tolerance for other tribal or minority groups. He ordered 40,000 Asians to leave Uganda in 1972 and simply confiscated their property. You know, up and down the length and breadth of the eastern part of Africa, and that was very true in Kenya, there were many Asians, and most of these were either from the nation of India or Pakistan. They were Muslim by religion. They were basically educated and intelligent people, and they were the merchant class. In many of those cities, they were the people who were the shop owners. They were the people who were in charge of the businesses. They were the importers and exporters. It was by their own craft and by their skill, by their education, that many an East African city flourished and enjoyed a tremendous amount of trade and became really quite a comfortable city. In tiresome story after story, as leadership reverted into the hands of some of the black governments there, those people found themselves on the way out. Their properties were taken away. It has been almost like that hideous and very embarrassing saga in American history of the takeover of the homes, the properties, and the farms of the Japanese people who were American, as much American as any other American had ever been, but who in those early days of fear-ridden terror in World War II found themselves summarily rounded up, herded off into concentration camps. Oh, we like to call them internment places, but it might as well have been a concentration camp. Concentration merely means a concentration of people. Doesn't mean it's any more nerve-wracking or any less to be put in some place up by Tule Lake in California or Idaho or someplace else, surrounded by barbed wire and little huts, as it did to be moved into Dachau or Buchenwald. But those people found their jobs, their trucks, their homes, their farms gone. And in many a case, and you've seen it sensationalized afterward, when they got back years later, it was impossible to ever get that property back. Now, that's a very shameful little chapter in American history. But by the same token, and in this case, lacking the problem of the fright of attack from an enemy or lacking the problem of an impending war of some kind, it was merely a governmental change that brought about the tremendous exploitation and discrimination in the form of nationalization of private businesses, homes, and properties. And it represented who knows what percentage of the wealth of the country. This was very true in the nation of Kenya. I talked to a lady over there one time who had been, I guess, third generation in the nation. She'd been a teacher for over 20 years. She was very sadly shaking her head about it. She was in a hotel, already packed up, ready to leave. And she was talking of how terrible everything was becoming, how intolerable it was to even walk along the streets, and she was going to have to leave now. I understood that sisal, if that's the way the British pronounce it, which is that kind of a hemp plant that is grown in Tamaulipas State in Mexico around Victoria, and I think that is one of the now major areas from which the rope-making hemp comes that you find in the world. Well, Kenya used to have vast plantations of sisal, as it was called, or of hemp. Now, I don't even know whether they export any anymore, because so many of the British ranchers and farmers who were there, second, third, fourth generation people who lived there all their lives and felt, I guess, as much a person of that nation as any American, whether he's first generation, second, and certainly by the time you're a third generation American, if your name is Giuseppe Rigoletto or something, you don't take it very kindly if you think there is some move in American government just because your name is Italian to kick you out and take your property away. And when you've been there by the second and third generation, your grandparents before you emigrated to a country, and you've grown up there just because you got a different background, you got an old country. Well, the same thing is true because the skin variation is slightly different because there were whites who were farmers and ranchers in nations such as Tanzania, Kenya, and the like, that go on for generations back. Well, they didn't want to see their ranches and farms, homes, businesses, automobiles taken away and confiscated, but that's exactly what happened. The same comment for Asians that came from India. These were the merchant class, and they were largely kicked out because the pressures became absolutely unbearable and the government took over their properties. Now, of course, the United States cooperates 100% with Kenya or with Tanzania. When Dr. Kissinger goes over there, he's given a hero's welcome. He's received very friendly by those nations, in Zambia and the like. And yet the policies of those governments toward minorities, not only of their own color, but toward Asians and toward whites from Europe, especially Britain, have been just as much in the naked form of the worst kind of exploitation, racial discrimination, as any other discrimination you can find on the African continent or elsewhere. So it seems to me that we got a double standard there somewhere. Now, when the double standard is lifted and when we find one criteria that applies equally to all, then it's a different matter. But right now, if you look at countries where there have been flights of refugees because of violent change, why, it's quite a list of nations all over Africa. And it begins to make me wonder whether or not the same kind of thing is going to occur in the most developed countries of South Africa and Rhodesia, where nuclear reactors are busy these days. It's kind of interesting to wonder. You see, black guerrilla campaigns in white-ruled Rhodesia and Southwest Africa have already driven thousands of blacks to seek refuge in Botswana, Zambia, and Mozambique.
just as thousands of them had to flee during the Angolan Civil War. We don't seem to realize, and I've seen the pictures, and they're so gory and bloody that it just makes you sick to your stomach to even see them, in books which have been published and available on bookstores on the streets of the cities in Rhodesia, that the black guerrillas had come across the border from Mozambique and Zambia to attack. You might hear of a greatly publicized attack against a white caravan or something, which is true, but what you don't hear is that for years and years there has been guerrilla warfare going on where the principal sufferers are the black tribespeople living in their villages in the bush nearest those borders. And when you see pictures of beheaded and dismembered little black babies which were butchered by a great big machete in the hands of another black, it doesn't make any sense to you at all. They may even be of the same tribe, but they live in a little narrow area there of a kind of a buffer zone of forest land and veld that separates a couple of nations, and because of political differences, the blacks on one side of that border, in this case perhaps in Mozambique, who look just exactly alike the blacks on the other side, in this case Rhodesia, come over there and butcher women and children, and this is called guerrilla warfare and supposed to be an effort to unseat a white minority. Well, what are they killing the blacks for then? Doesn't make any sense at all. Now you see that they're trying to achieve some kind of a goal by sitting down in Geneva and solving it all. Well, they're not all really pursuing the same goal. And it's been very plainly stated that that African National Council is not there in a spirit of give and take. That was said by one faction of that black council. It was stated, and I quote, "The ANC is not here in a spirit of give and take. We have come here only to take." Interesting, isn't it? The spirit that sometimes motivates political conferences. So after a round of blatant, angry and intransigent opening statements, the conference adjourned for a few days. The British diplomats were hopeful they could get them back to hammer out some kind of a compromise, and of course Secretary Kissinger was probably sitting in the sidelines hoping the same thing could occur, that they could have a multiracial interim government and a black majority rule within 2 years. Well, it makes you wonder, why bother? And if there were, and I'm not saying there were, I'm just saying if there were any overtones in the Ford campaign to keep Dr. Kissinger abroad and overseas so it wouldn't be a problem to foul up things here at home, and at the same time, to score as heavily as they could among the black vote, you better take a look at the statistics of the percentage of blacks who voted for Jimmy Carter anyway, and find out whether or not all this move to try to force Southern Africa into the hands of black majority rulership was so successful on the part of the Republican administration that it made any difference whatsoever in the presidential election in the United States. But it's going on, isn't it? If you think it's going to end racism, color discrimination, economic exploitation, and privileges in society, I want to tell you, all in the world that is happening there is you're going to see the substitution of one form of evil for another form, which will be far more brutal. Well, the current number of the Plain Truth magazine shows how at least one nation in Southwest Africa is racing against time for peace. And it's quite inspiring and quite eye-opening. If you'll write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine and also get this article, "Is Our Environment Driving Us Bananas? The Origin of Astrology and 25 Years to Double Food Production," you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, or you can dial a toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That'll be repeated again in just a moment. Tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye. Bye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. We'll